Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. Right now in Jerusalem, President Trump meeting with the president of Israel, Reuven Rivlin. He fought in the Six Days War 50 years ago. Here is the president of the United States.
Together. And now today being in Israel is just very, very special for us. So we expect to have some very interesting talks.
Absolutely. We are praying for peace and we are pushing for peace for the last 100 years. And with God's help, somebody will bring us peace all together. All together. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, a photo opportunity now. You can hear the cameras going behind the United States and the Israeli flags and in attendance. Can't really guess the crowd size. I would guess maybe 100 journalists as well. And we're, again, shifting to another scene where perhaps we'll have more formal comments by Mr. Trump. He is in Jerusalem, landing at Tel Aviv earlier today, and by helicopter to Jerusalem. Right now, with David Gura in Boston, I'm Tom Keene in New York. Jerome Schneider with us with PIMCO in our New York studios. Jerome, thank you for all of us for being so patient news flow this morning. Let's get basic here on a Monday. We've seen the Trump trade fade, steeper yield curve. We've rolled over clearly based on news events. To a pro like you, what does curve flattening mean?
Ultimately, it means that we should be expecting rates to move higher over the near term. And I think that, you know, with that in mind, it's also, you know, a relatively healthy economy that one can point to. And ultimately, that what we see in the market is very different than what we should project in the market. Let me be clear about that. Ultimately, when you look at short-term interest rate expectations, we've seen a very drastic move over the past week or two in terms of the expectations of a June rate hike. The reality is that when you look at the flattening of the yield curve specifically over the past few days, we should expect those rates to move higher, more probability weighted than the market is expecting. So simply put, rates are moving higher and we should be preparing for that.
Well, we should be preparing for that. And I guess I see it with a 1.29% two-year yield as well. It's away from your remit in short-term paper, but nevertheless, I know you're wired at PIMCO on weaker dollar, stronger oil. Which is the horse and which is the cart?
Well, ultimately, you know, I think you have to look at the dollar because that ultimately is what the Fed is going to key off of. When you look at the Fed's transition from this data-dependent model to more of a conditions-dependent model, financial conditions-dependent model back in 2016, that's really what we have to focus on. The data is there for the rate hike. The only reason that the Fed doesn't increase rates over the next 6 months or so by one or maybe even two times is that the financial conditions tighten. So being conditions-dependent is simply driven by data. Driven by volatility in currency, specifically the view of the dollar. So I put more weight on the dollar than oil right now. But it is interesting, Tom, and this is noteworthy, is that we basically have seen whatever it takes policy from OPEC and some of the producers, and that sort of found a floor. And that could have actually pretty positive implications potentially for not only the global economy, but really the domestic economy. As you looked forward to that stabilization, it could lead to other things, including CapEx, capital expenditures increasing. And ultimately, you know, that creates some stability and upward propensity for the economy.
Let's play that out a little bit here. We saw news from the Saudi oil minister over the weekend that Saudi Arabia and other participants in that OPEC and non-OPEC deal are willing and eager to continue it. What does that mean for the economy going forward?
Well, ultimately, the downside risk, if you will, to lower oil prices is something that domestic producers are going to be willing to increase their capital expenditures, or at least maintain it. We've seen it in rig growth here over the past few months. But ultimately, it's sort of been a seesaw. You know, when one party, producing party, has cut, the other sort of increased slightly, or vice versa. And I think what the goal is to try to achieve a healthy balance, centered around $50, maybe it dips slightly below, but ultimately create that stability. And that's ultimately what all producers want, so that they can forecast and maintain profit margins without being whipsawed in terms of putting outlays that may ultimately prove to be, at least in the near term, unprofitable.
I want to go back to that distinction you were drawing between data dependence and conditions dependence. Is this something that we see the Fed embracing, talking about? Help me understand just the difference a little bit more.
Well, yes, and ultimately you can look at even, you know, the speeches from Cleveland President Meister and others, you know, from even the most dovish to the most hawkish. Everybody points to, here's the situation, but if this happens, then we may not be moving. Everybody wants to normalize the balance sheet. Everybody wants that normalization process to continue. But if that, you know, does, if a certain situation evolves, then they might have to react. So that conditions dependency is critical to the markets. And we know, generally speaking, the data, it's sort of firm. We sort of know an idea. Sure, mm-hmm. Q1 GDP was a bit disappointing, but jobs data, even wage pressures are relatively stable. Although inflation, admittedly, from the headline perspective, is a bit disappointing, those are things that they can, quote, look through, and we're all well aware of that. But this conditions is the factor that toggles the decision-making process of the Fed this June.
Within the debate, Jerome Snyder at PIMCO with us, within the debate at PIMCO about how the American economy will prosper, we can all agree there are gains occurring right now. But once again, are the gains going to the few versus being spread across a wider part of the American populace?
Well, that has to be ultimately, there's going to be a few policy implications in this, and you can look at it from retrospect, and clearly, you know, since the financial crisis, it's been skewed one way. But I think ultimately we have to look, Tom, about what the policy is looking forward. You know, we have a period of time here where animal spirits have been relatively constructive. They've basically been fermenting over periods of time, and we see that in both the, you know, corporate world and also in the retail, the individual investor world. But as we move forward, we have to really look and see if there's risks on the horizon. You know, we were very concerned about at the beginning of the Trump presidency about things like protectionism and trends to deglobalization. But it's quite possible those don't materialize to the severe point that people had expected. And so those are positive implications, ultimately, that sort of tilt to the positive side. Mm-hmm. I'm not being Pollyanna-ish here, and I'm not being overly optimistic.
It's not allowed at PIMCO.
Of course not. If you've been to any one of our investment committee meetings, hey. You know, we all have to put our real hats on and sometimes our hard hats. But at the same time, this is something that is going to be the trade-off. If animal spirits are going to continue, how does it evolve? Yeah. And policy implications are one of the key factors of the next 6 months to drive that.
Final thoughts with Jerome Snyder of PIMCO this morning. Are we just clipping coupons? Is the goal, Jerome, given all the noise that's out there in your statement of a higher rate environment, is the goal just to make the coupon and defend?
Well, the goal is preserve capital. The goal is to preserve capital with the notion that inflation is gently increasing. So purchasing power and preserving purchasing power is the essential element of proper investing these days, specifically with those bent for fixed income allocations. And I think once you move to a higher rate paradigm, which we're clearly moving and edging toward that over the next 1, 2, maybe even 3 years, you know, it becomes ever more apparent that becomes attractive. So maintaining optionality to defend against higher rates by having limited exposure to interest rates, but at the same time, ability to embrace those higher interest rates predominantly through items such as hedging and even as simple as owning floating rate product, floating rate notes, is essential. One thing just to highlight, Tom, here is, you know, we see LIBOR and sort of the money market instruments, although it's clearly not a harbinger of doom or stress in the marketplace, but 1 month LIBOR crossed 1% for the first time since December of 2008 last week. And so it's noteworthy that we are finally seeing some tip of the hat, at least, to a normalization happening in front-end markets as we move to the Fed that is obviously, as I mentioned previously, more conditions dependent.
Jerome, PIMCO had this big confab a couple of weeks back, this secular forum. Newt Gingrich was there. Larry Summers was there. The whole lot. What did you take away from that about where things are headed in Washington, how that's going to dovetail with the work that you do?
Yeah, once every year we like to bring in folks from the outside to help shed some light on corners of the realm, corners of the universe that we normally don't see. And as you mentioned, we did have our normal lineup of Bernanke and Trichet and Gordon Brown. But at the same time, we're really focused on how the world will evolve, looking at ultimately at animal spirits, how they'll effectively move the economy going forward, both domestically and globally. Implications of things we obviously are well aware of: populism, political populism, ebbing and flowing. You know, obviously France and the election outcome there was very poignant in that. And then ultimately, figuring out where we stand in the world. We're at a point where clearly we've been utilizing monetary policy in excess for the past 7, 8, 9 years. And is that remain, or how do we evolve out of that situation? And those aren't concurrent, clearly, as the Fed debates one side of it and other monetary policy committees are debating the other side. But ultimately, that, quote, end game will be very important. So we debated that as well. So those ideas will be forthcoming, and we encourage everybody to look at the PIMCO website for them to be published in the forthcoming days.
Okay, there's a shameless plug. Get rid of them.
I teed that up, but we get a budget tomorrow. We're headed toward a government shutdown in September. If we don't have a spending figured out by then, how worried are you about all of that?
Yeah, ultimately, am I worried right this second? No. But this is sort of festering in the background. And ultimately, you cannot overlook the debt ceiling implications later on this year. So when we come back later on this summer, while we might view it as a quiet summer, this is going to be at the forefront of the implications for us to pay attention to.
Jerome, thank you so much. Jerome Schneider, more than patient with the global news flow this morning. He is with PIMCO. Impatiently waiting in Boston with the Red Sox one game above 500 after losing three straight in a row to the Oakland A's. He's up there to assist John Farrell, David Gura.
Yes, Tom, thanks so much. Here with Yuri and Timmer, the director of Global Macro Fidelity Investments. He was giving me the lay of the land here. Beautiful bureau here, our Bloomberg 1200 studios, high up overlooking a lot of the city. Yuri, great to have you with us. And let's start with oil. We heard Karen Moscow a few moments ago talking about the potential for an extension of that OPEC and non-OPEC production freeze agreement. Give us your sense of your optimism for that and sort of what that means for markets going forward.
Yes, well, a very good morning to you. I'm pretty bullish on oil. I think eventually we're going to go higher. The oil complex will be trading in deficit, which will be a big change from where it has been. And most people probably agree with that. It's just a matter of timing and how long does it take to work off all of that excess inventory. So certainly the news out of OPEC is helpful if you're bullish. And one of the key indicators I tend to look at is the CRB raw industrial, CRB RIND on your Bloomberg, and that's been in a pretty sustained uptrend. And I think it's a better measure than, for instance, copper or iron ore, which have been under pressure lately, as well as oil. So I think commodities are in a good place here to continue to rally.
Commodities in a good place. When you look at the U.S. economy overall, what's your sense of it? What's still lacking or lagging when you look at it now?
So there's so much noise and headlines and tweeting and this and that. And I think a lot of people tend to attribute everything that's happening to the latest headlines. And the way I see it, sort of the forest through the trees, if you will, there are really two major issues that we have to get right. One is China. China just pumped a lot of credit into the system to reflate yet again their credit impulse, which actually is an indicator that you guys developed on Bloomberg, is running at a 30% of GDP rate, but the year-over-year change has gone from plus 10 to now minus 1. So that credit impulse has come and gone. So one question is, what is the aftermath of that going to look like? My sense is that the global reflation is still intact, and I have liked non-U.S. equities all year, and I continue to do.
Yeah.
And the other one is, what kind of late cycle in the U.S. are we actually heading in? And this is where the fiscal stuff comes in, because the wrong fiscal kind of stimulus that pushes the demand side could actually shorten the cycle, which is kind of ironic, because it could push the Fed into overdrive and therefore invert the curve and then lead us into a recession. But less actually could be more in that sense.
Right. Yuri and Tim are with us with Fidelity out of Babson College. As you know, Yuri, and there is no bad house in the neighborhood around Babson College. It's in a pretty fancy clime of Boston, Massachusetts. I like on your note you provide clarity by saying the U.S. is the best house in the neighborhood, but there are other places to buy right now. Why the shift?
Because we are in a global reflation from since about five quarters ago. So from 2011 to 2016, the U.S. was the best house in a neighborhood. But now it's actually only one of a number of good houses. And this is why non-U.S. equities, whether it's developed or emerging markets, have actually done very well. They're actually up more since the election than the U.S. market, which very few people would have predicted 6 months ago. So I do think this is a global story. China is very much behind it. And as long as China can sort of keep its stuff together, I think global equities will continue to not only go up, but actually outperform the U.S.
Do you see cash flow sustained? I mean, one of the big surprises here has been the rise in earnings and revenues. I mean, they were pretty good, weren't they?
Yes. Q1 earnings for the S&P are up 14% year over year. And that's that of course, those are easy comps, of course, because the Q1 of last year was the bottom of the cycle when earnings were falling at 7%. But it's a global story. Earnings are inflecting higher everywhere. And you have a pretty significant PE discount, you know, in EM at 12, which, of course, is justified. You just have to look at Brazil last week to know why. But even non-U.S. Equities are trading at a 14 multiple, whereas the U.S. is at an 18 multiple on a forward earnings basis. So the earnings story is good. If you look at the calendar year numbers for 2017 and you adjust for the normal downward drift that happens to estimates, earnings should be up 8% over 2016. And in 2018, which, of course, is still miles away, would be up 6% on that math. And those numbers don't really reflect any potential boost from either tax cuts and or deregulation. So I don't think it's fair to say that on the earnings estimate side, people have unusually optimistic expectations. If there's a premium built in, it's on the valuation side, which I do think can be an issue going forward.
There was for such a time, for many months now, political risk driving so much. Has that dissipated now? Are you returning now to a sense that monetary policy, central banking is back in the driver's seat once again? Is political risk off the table to the degree that it was with France, with the French election now over with?
Yes, I've been very bullish on Europe, sort of expecting that to be the sleeper hit of 2017. And, you know, but people were very focused on election risk, certainly after Brexit and after the U.S. election. And when that didn't materialize, and actually the Dutch election a few months earlier was already a hint that populism might actually be contained in Europe, and I suspect that seems to be that is the case. But there is political risk always, of course. But when we're seeing on the trade front, which is really where the international risk is, so far things have been pretty benign. You know, we've had summits and meetings with international leaders, and it's been kind of dovish on the trade side.
Right.
And on the fiscal side domestically, we're still waiting, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of momentum. So it's steady as she goes right now.
Very good, Jerome. Yuri and Tim are with us with Fidelity. In Jerusalem, at the presidential residence with a garden, is assembled the U.S. delegation with President Trump. And this includes comments by Reuven Rivlin, the president of Israel, not the prime minister, Mr. Netanyahu, the president. And, of course, with Mr. Trump. It is two podium with the U.S. flag on the left, the Israeli flag on the right, and the president's flag, I believe, in the center, and the national flag, I should state, as well. It is a spectacular backdrop at the presidential residence. And, of course, this creates great resonance within Israel, really pretty much in the heart of Jerusalem. So the president, President Rivlin, speaking right now, I think we'll wait on that and wait for Mr. Trump to begin his comments here in a moment. David Gura, all of Washington is watching this trip, but busy on an airplane returning is Mr. Priebus and Mr. Bannon. Do we know, David, this morning why Priebus and Bannon are returning to Washington?
I don't think that we have a great sense of that. The White House is saying that was in the plans all along. Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross also heading back to Washington as well. Marty Shanker and I were talking a little earlier about the complement of staff the president brought with him to Saudi Arabia. Of course, there were a number of big business deals that were announced there. The president gave that speech to regional leaders on Sunday afternoon. So the White House maintaining here, this was in the cards all along for those two men to head back. But you're right in pointing out the drama that exists in Washington, continues to exist and persist. There will be reports here that there could be a hearing with James Comey this week on Capitol Hill, the former FBI director. So that story, which the White House so desperately wanted to leave behind, is certainly continuing in Washington, D.C. this week.
Now, the symbolism from Saudi Arabia to Israel and then on to the Rome and the Vatican on an extended trip, I will point out that the president, just as a casual observer from a distance like all of us, looks a lot more rested today than he did when he gave his speech, David, in Saudi. There's no question that he looked exhausted here 12 and 24 hours ago.
A nine-day trip with two summits, Marty Shanker commenting earlier as well, you know, foreign travel is difficult. This is the first foreign trip that the president has taken, the first official trip that he's taken overseas. It is jam-packed, involves a lot of geographical breadth, as you're mentioning, and just it's a lot to get one's head around. Anyone who's traveled with a government official at that kind of rank knows that everything is tightly scheduled. You're in a bubble. Everything, every minute is taken. Kind of like when you go to Davos, Tom. Every minute is pre-scheduled in advance.
Oh, but I will take issue in that I once did the trip where it was every day here, day there.
Yeah.
The moving city to city is a whole nother level of exhaustion, whether it's Asia or Europe or North America. As a president's doing, and of course many of our listeners, particularly C-class officers, are doing as well.
Thank you very much. And shalom. I'm honored to be in the great state of Israel, the homeland of the Jewish people. I am awed by the beauty and majesty of this sacred and very holy land. President Rivlin, Mrs. Rivlin, thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you for opening your wonderful home and welcoming Melania and myself to your amazing country. And that's what it is. It is an amazing country. What you've done is perhaps has virtually never been done before. On my first trip overseas, I've come to this ancient land to reaffirm the enduring friendship between the United States and the State of Israel. And it will always be enduring. And that's number one to me. We are not only longtime friends, we are great allies and partners. We stand together always. This moment in history calls for us to strengthen our cooperation as both Israel and America face common threats from ISIS and other terrorist groups to countries like Iran that sponsor terrorism and fund and foment terrible violence, not only here, but all over the world. Together, we can work to end the scourge of violence that has taken so many lives here in Israel and around the world. Most importantly, the United States and Israel can declare with one voice that Iran must never be allowed to possess a nuclear weapon, never, ever, and must cease its deadly funding, training, and equipping of terrorists and militias. And it must cease immediately. On those issues, there is a strong consensus among the nations of the world, including many in the Muslim world. I was deeply encouraged by my conversations with Muslim world leaders in Saudi Arabia, including King Salman, who I spoke to at great length. King Salman feels very strongly, and I can tell you would love to see peace between Israel and the Palestinians. Many expressed their resolve to help end terrorism and the spread of radicalization. Many Muslim nations have already taken steps to begin following through on this commitment.
There is a growing realization among your Arab neighbors that they have common cause with you in the threat posed by Iran. And it is indeed a threat. There's no question about that. I thank both you and Prime Minister Netanyahu for your commitment to achieving peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. I also look forward to discussing the peace process with Palestinian President Abbas. Young Israeli and Palestinian children deserve to grow up in safety and to follow their dreams free from the violence that has destroyed so many lives. The United States and Israel can also bring safety and greater prosperity to our people through stronger ties of trade and commerce. Already, our two countries do a great deal of business together. We have a strong foundation on which to build an even closer trading relationship that benefits both of our countries. I'm going to try and narrow that trade deficit just a little bit. Is that okay? He doesn't mind. He wants to keep it the way it is. I understand. Today, we have so many incredible opportunities before us, and my hope for this visit is that we seize every single one of them. I am thrilled to be here on behalf of the American people. I know Israel and America share the same goals, and I have great confidence that we can achieve tremendous success together. We can achieve all of our goals together. President Rivlin, I look forward to working with you and to seeing more of the sacred land and getting to spend time with the remarkable people of Israel. Thank you very much. Thank you.
The President of the United States shaking hands with the President of Israel, Mr. Rivlin. This at the presidential residence in the heart of Jerusalem, in the rows and chairs, the First Lady in the front row, listening to the comments with a beautiful backdrop of flags and artwork in Jerusalem. The President looks more spirited than he looked in Riyadh, to be honest. It looks like he's had a little bit of rest, which you can do on Air Force One. 900 miles roughly from Riyadh to Tel Aviv, and then 36 miles by helicopter from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem to the southeast as well. The President just now making comments with Mr. Rivlin as some people gather around, not too many, and the First Lady we see as well. I saw Secretary Tillerson as well in the front row out for what appears to be photo opportunities with flags draped on a sun-drenched patio in Jerusalem. Enough of the travel log. Greg Villiers just out with his note. We had the courtesy of speaking with him earlier this morning. He says an epic battle over fiscal policy begins this week. Urien Timmer is with Fidelity. Urien, how do you link fiscal policy and the raging battle to come on it into investment? How does that work?
Well, when you look at all the things that are unfolding in the market, so the dollar, nominal yields, real rates, TIPS breakevens, financial conditions, commodities, the relative performance of the Russell versus the S&P, they're all manifestations of the same theme. And that theme is, what kind of late cycle will the U.S. see? So we've been in this prolonged mid-cycle expansion, the sort of the Goldilocks period, really from 2010 until now, and we're still in it. And I don't expect to transition into late cycle, you know, tomorrow, but it is usually the next phase in the business cycle. You go early, mid, late, down. And the late cycle is when things get kind of messy because no late cycle is the same. And so where the fiscal question comes in, when is it going to happen? Is it going to happen? How much? What kind, right? If it pushes up the demand side with an economy at full employment 8 years into an expansion, the risk is that the Fed has to offset that and therefore not only lower the fiscal multiplier of that stimulus, but also raise rates and, you know, get us closer to the risk of an inverted yield curve down the road. And then, you know the relationship between inverted curves and recessions. So that's one potential playbook. The other one is that the fiscal either is less than we think or it's more supply side oriented because we need productivity to go up in order for the economy speed limit to go up. And if that happens, the Fed doesn't have to offset it as much, and we may have a more benign environment, more benign late cycle environment where the curve does not invert. So this, I think, is the big question other than China and its stimulus. This is really the big question. And that's why whenever we see headlines going to or fro in terms of when we get how much fiscal, all of these market components move in unison because it's all one trade, basically.
Aaron Timmer with us with Fidelity, and we will continue. The president and the first lady walking with the president and Mrs. Rivlin within the presidential residence. They visited the garden. They take immense pride in Israel with the presidential garden at the residence. It was completely restored in 2009 to represent the flora of the land of Israel. It looks now like a red carpet and flags assembled as the president moves on to the next moment. I believe I see a car in the distance. Urien, when I look at investment right now, do you know where the risk-free return is? It's so important to your managers, your portfolio managers. In the great distortion, do I know where the risk-free rate is?
Yes. And this is no, we don't. Well, we can guess, right? Because the
you're supposed to say Peter Lynch knows, but no one else does. Where is it?
So when you look at valuation, right? Valuation is driven by the numerator in the discounted cash flow model, which is earnings growth, and then the denominator, which is the discount rate, which is the sum of the risk-free rate and the equity risk premium. And right now, one of the issues that I have in the market is that not only is the equity risk premium very low because it basically collapsed after the election, the risk premium is about 2.3%, which is almost half of what it historically has been, but also the risk-free rate, as you just indicated, is depressed because we've had multiple years of financial repression and, you know, ZIRP and QE. And where does the 10-year yield belong? Because that is the risk-free rate. And once we know that, then we can sort of figure out what the valuation is of all these other asset classes. But because the risk-free rate is artificially depressed, all asset classes become, you know, more highly valued as a result, you know, from bonds to cash to equities to credit. And so we can make some analyses on where the term premium is and should be if the Fed was completely in a normalized environment where GDP growth was historically at trend, which of course it isn't. You know, real GDP growth over the last 10 years is at 1.3%. It's very, very low.
Right.
But if growth returned to something normal, 3-4% real or 5-6% nominal, you could argue that the 10-year should be at, you know, 4% or 4.5%. But we're not there.
Urien, thank you so much, and particularly for the back and forth with the president in Jerusalem. Mr. Timmer is with Fidelity in Boston. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith Incorporated. There's something new from Bloomberg. It's called Lens. Starting right now, you can use the Bloomberg iOS app off your iPhone or iPad or our new Google Chrome extension to read any news story on any website, scan it, and then instantly see the news story's relevant market data from Bloomberg. In addition, see all the bios of the key people mentioned in the story. It's called Lens, and it is just that, a lens into the people and the data of any story you may be reading. Again, Lens brings you the power of Bloomberg's news and data. Download our iOS app or search for the Bloomberg extension at the Chrome Store to try Lens out. Learn more at Bloomberg.com/lens. Michael McKee in studio with us right now. Mr. Gura is on assignment in Boston. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. It's nice to be back. And Richard Truman is producing.
You know,
it's like the old days.
It's like nostalgia.
They put the band back together again.
It's great. It's Spinal Tap. Show goes to 11.
It may go to 11. We're going to get to Bruce Bartlett here in a moment. I just want to continue with the day's events in Jerusalem. We're seeing images now on our feed of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre back to the 4th century. Mr. Trump and the First Lady scheduled to visit, as well as the Western Wall. No activity there as yet, but we'll bring you a dialogue of that as we see it on our images here. Right now, a dialogue is necessary on the future of the Republican Party. I turned to our Kieran Buchanan a week ago, and I said, I want to talk to one person only, the guy that helped Jack Kemp. Bruce Bartlett, a few years ago, out of Georgetown, assisted Mr. Kemp in moving tax reform forward. Bruce, take us back to that moment. How impossible was it to do tax reform then, and is it the same impossibility now?
Well, for one thing, a lot of people knew a lot more about the idea of tax reform because we'd been talking about it since the late 1960s. We had a big tax reform bill in 1969 and another one in 1976. So in the 1980s, when Kemp started talking about doing another tax reform, the ground was pretty well plowed. People had an understanding about the problem of tax loopholes and how they could be harmful to the economy by causing investment to be misallocated and things of that sort. And he started working on a tax reform plan with Senator Bob Casten of Wisconsin. And simultaneously, Senator Bill Bradley of New Jersey and Congressman Dick Gephardt were working on something similar. And they were both Democrats. Kemp and Casten were both Republicans. And when they finally came up with their legislation and put them side by side, they discovered there was a lot of overlap. And I think that was the real impetus that got things going, the idea that this was potentially a win-win bipartisan deal.
Well, since 1986, of course, Congress has meddled in the tax code. You won't get any argument, I don't think, from any economist that the tax code exemptions and loopholes distort economic activity. So what's the difference between 2017 and the early 80s when this was gestating in terms of why we need to do taxes? Why are people so in so much disagreement about tax cuts now compared to then?
Well, the problem is that the Tax Reform Act of 86 was essentially a deal whereby taxes were raised on corporations and that revenue was used to reduce tax rates on individuals. That's a political deal that worked. The problem today is almost everybody in the tax field thinks that the most important thing we need to do is lower the corporate tax rate, but there aren't enough corporate tax loopholes to pay for more than a small reduction in rates, which means that in principle, you'd have to raise taxes on individuals to pay for a corporate tax cut, assuming it was done revenue neutral.
Bruce, I want to come back on the Republican Party, but just one more tax question, if we could. Do you have any optimism we can see Speaker Ryan, Ronald Reagan tax reform?
Not really. I think we're still at too early a stage of discussion. And you're seeing a fault line of a group of Republicans say, screw reform. We just want another 1981-style big tax cut. We don't give a damn what happens to the deficit. And then you have another side which says, we're concerned about the deficit. We want to pay for this tax reform. But more importantly, there's a rule in the Senate which says if you pass legislation that reduces that increases the deficit in over a 10-year budget window, it can't be made permanent. Mm-hmm. And so this is a very powerful argument for doing something, reform that would be paid for, that would be revenue neutral, because then it would be permanent and businesses could plan beyond that 10-year window.
Bruce Bartlett is a Republican, and he has been harshly critical of modern Republican theology. Bruce Bartlett, is the president a Republican?
Well, of course he is. He's the nominee of the Republican Party, which means he is a Republican insofar as the Republican Party itself is concerned.
Yes. Is he a conservative, I guess, is the real question.
Well, he's certainly much more of a populist, I think, than a traditional conservative. But on the other hand, it's quite clear that he is pursuing an agenda that is very much in the mainstream of the conservative movement as it exists today, which may or may not have any connection whatsoever to historical conservatism or the conservatism of the Reagan era, which was my era.
Well, that's an interesting point you make, because in your book in 2009, the New American Economy, The Failure of Reaganomics and a New Way Forward, you suggest supply-side economics was appropriate for the 1970s and 80s, but do not work today. Do you still feel that way? And if so, tell us why, given that that's being cited by many people around the administration for what they want to do.
Well, I don't believe in cookie-cutter economics, okay? I think you look at the situation, you analyze it, and you develop policies that are appropriate for those circumstances. And I think there's a lot of people out there, such as my old friend Larry Kudlow, who just say tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts. No matter what the situation is,
right.
You know, it's always time to cut taxes. And I think sometimes it isn't. And I think cutting taxes in the early 1980s was something that was clearly necessary. The fact that we had inflation was strong evidence that the supply side of the economy needed to be built up. But I think in the 21st century, we've had mostly the opposite problem. We've had we have not had inflation. We've had a borderline deflation. I think we're still suffering from a lack of aggregate demand. I think we need different policies for a different situation.
Bruce, when you look at the present dynamics and the present politics that's out there, I guess it's gridlock. I've called it Trump lock as well. Is gridlock a good thing right now? Or do you feel there's a huge pressure by Republicans to actually find the compromise you've called for decades?
It's hard to see Republicans compromising even with themselves at this point on some key issues. Taxes is a key one. It looks as if the administration has adopted a let's just cut taxes and forget about all this reform stuff. But the House of Representatives, at least, seems to be quite determined to do a meaningful tax reform bill, and it's not entirely clear where the House is, or the Senate is. And again, I think you've got differences among the administration, the House and the Senate on health reform and a number of other issues. So I think just getting Republicans on the same page is going to be an enormous effort.
Before we let you go, I have to go back to Texas for a second and ask a question. I've been dying to find an expert who could tell me, and you're probably exactly the person. The administration goes out, we want to cut taxes. They put out a rough idea of what they want to do, and everybody says tax cuts for the rich, tax cuts for the rich. And when you look at it, obviously the rich pay more in taxes, so dollar-wise they pay more. But why can't somebody design a tax plan that gives the same percentage gain to everybody?
Well, for one thing, you've got a huge percentage of the population that pays no federal income taxes at all. So you've got a problem with how to, in effect, give them a tax cut when they don't pay any. And the answer has been, over the last several years, let's give them refundable tax credits. And once you do that, you've blurred the distinction between taxes and spending. You're sending checks to people who pay no taxes and saying, we're going to give you a rebate on your taxes. And this has kind of opened the door to a spigot of spending that many Republicans, in fact, are concerned about.
Bruce, thank you so much for your time and a busy news day. Bruce Bartlett of Virginia and, of course, a Republican. The symbolism at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre right now in Jerusalem is remarkable. The president and Mrs. Trump entering the church along with their daughter and Mr. Kushner as well, and a few of the American dignitaries. And they are surrounded, Michael McKee, by that imagery of Jerusalem, of the Greek Orthodox, the Armenian Orthodox, and the Catholic Church. Joining us now in Boston, Karen Mills. She's a former Small Business Administrator, 23rd head of the SBA, now at the Harvard Kennedy School. Karen, good morning. What did you learn in as a small business administrator? What was the shock? There's always a shock when you enter the bureaucracy. What'd you learn?
Well, Tom, it's great to talk to you. I think the thing that I learned and that we really learned in the recession in this country is how important small businesses are to the economy, because half the people who work in this country own or work for a small business. So I used to say I woke up at night worrying about half of America's jobs. The issue is that small business doesn't really have a big voice in Washington, because big business's voice is much more at the table. So my job was to be a loud voice at the table for small business.
Karen, we're going to interrupt right now and go to a big business. 8 miles west of Detroit is Dearborn, Michigan. Here is Bill Ford.
And he did that. And of course, they still made furniture throughout the whole, and they still make furniture. But in doing so, he grew the company, took them to first in the industry worldwide. And the culture was one of optimism and a feeling that they could get things done easily, because they had a very clear view of the future. Then Jim went to the University of Michigan. And you can say, well, is that relevant to what Ford has got going? I would say, yeah, in a couple respects. Look at what he did. He walked into an athletic department. First of all, it shows his loyalty, because having played football for Bo Schembechler, he loved the University of Michigan. And when they asked him, could he come fix the athletic department, Jim said, sure, I'd be happy to, walking into a very difficult and very public situation. So what did he do there? He first got the students back, because they were feeling alienated. Then he got all the volunteers that are the heart of any program like that. They were feeling alienated. He got them back. He negotiated and brought home the Nike deal, which was groundbreaking for any university. He then hired Jim Harbaugh. And then he helped select his successor, and then left the athletic department in much better shape than he found it. So you say, well, what does that have to do with Ford? Well, nothing directly, except I think it shows that Jim can be successful and operate in multi-environments. A corporate manufacturing environment in Steelcase, where he reimagined it and delivered a very, not only solid set of results, but delivered a very convincing future. By the way, he also got them through 08-09, which in the furniture business was tougher even than the auto business. So it shows his operating acumen as well as his visionary thinking. Then he's been a part of our board for 3 years. And then I asked Jim, I said, hey, we need to build a new business. And, could you help us do that? Or frankly, would you go do that for us? And so again, very selflessly, and you see that there's a pattern here, he left our board, joined our management team when he didn't have to do that, and life had more probably appealing options. But in a year, he's done an amazing job at Ford Smart.
A little technical difficulty there with Bill Ford and his discussion. Really something. What a story. Of course, he was born like others with every advantage, and was pretty much ignored. And then out of Hotchkiss, Princeton, and MIT, has dazzled people with his ability to avoid bankruptcy a number of years ago. And, of course, with the ascendancy and management of Mr. Mullally. And then challenges, as we hear from the board, with Mr. Fields. And they go on to new management. This morning, he mentioning the University of Michigan linkage there. We continue with Ms. Mills. Karen Mills, the former SBA administrator, joining us. This morning, Karen, I look at all of this, and whether it's Bill Ford in big business or Karen Mills in small business, at the end of the day, it's all about people, isn't it? How did you manage the expectations of you need people to make the SBA go? How did you do that?
Well, Tom, you know, with Bill Ford, this is actually really important for a small business, too, because as you see, they're making a change there. So you're right. People are everything. But when you look at the number of suppliers Ford has, they have to get it right, or we're in real trouble in small business land, particularly in the Midwest. One of the great things I did was travel all around the country and talk to small business suppliers. And what you really need in Washington is somebody who's got the sensibility of the small business owner and can help Congress figure out how to make a bill that actually works for small business. It's not about the big top headline. It's about the nuts and bolts and how much pain and suffering the small business owner has to go through.
There's a question. What would help the small business owner? And I ask that because everybody says cut their taxes. When you look at the list of things that small business owners tell the pollsters on a regular basis, that's not at the top of the list.
Well, I actually have a list, but I have a plan for sort of getting it through Congress. So while the president is out traveling and around the world, I think his economic team should get together and go to Congress and work with both parties in Congress and do a small business bill. And maybe we would call it the Small Business Growth Act of 2017. And we could stuff it with all these things that small businesses like. Start with a few tax credits, because that's the best thing for small business, rather than wait for a big tax bill. Small business is really getting anxious, I think, waiting for tax legislation. So let's do some taxes, let's do some regulatory simplification, and make sure there's access to capital. Things that people agree on already.
One of the things that Michael McKee and I agree on, Karen, and we can ask you this because you're living it, is the value of a liberal arts education. Bill Ford has a history degree out of a small school in New Jersey. I believe you did the right thing and took Act 10 at Harvard a few years ago. And you very much know the efforts of Bowdoin College. How important is liberal arts to small business and any business education today?
Well, I'm a big believer in liberal arts education. You know, it really helps you figure out how to think. And as you said, at Bowdoin and at Harvard and really around the community, you want somebody who can have a sense of, you know, what is the path forward. And that's not just figuring out how to do the numbers. That's about making judgments and studying history and thinking about how other people have coped with difficult situations. And when you look at Bowdoin College, I think that's one of the reasons why they have a disproportionate number of leaders, Joshua Chamberlain, George Mitchell, for a very small college in Maine. It's set up how you think about living a principled life and making decisions.
Plus, they have to survive the black flies every spring. Karen Mills, thank you
so
much.
Well, and the hard winters.
Don't forget the winters in Maine.
The winter goes from October to the third week of June. Karen Mills, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it. The former administrator for the Small Business Administration. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated.